This is the morning breakfast session, Great Presidents, Great Ideas, and it's my privilege to introduce Douglas Wilson from Knox College, who will be speaking on Lincoln. He is the Lawrence Professor, Distinguished Professor of Emeritus of English from Knox College. He's also the co-director of the Center for Lincoln Studies. He taught at Knox for 45 years and has written extensively on Lincoln. Before he did that, he also worked on Jefferson. His books on Lincoln include Lincoln's Sword, Honor's Voice, and Lincoln Before Washington, and it's a great privilege once again to have him here. Professor Wilson.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. It's a heartwarming sight to wake up and see the mountains in this brilliant sunshine and a bright the bright faces of people who get up early to listen to somebody talk about Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln is of course, the best-known historical figure among Americans, and so he pays the price and gets the benefit for that. And one of the interesting things about Lincoln, it seems to me, is that he, in the changes of the way in which we teach history, he seems to persist. He's the one exception. Big name political figures have moved to the back in recent historiography and in teaching, and American history has tried to compensate by concentrating more on grassroots history, history from the bottom up and so forth. But still Lincoln persists, and I think it's probably because somewhere along the line he got installed in the elementary school curriculum. He's still taught in the fourth and fifth grades. And I came across an example of this, which I think is interesting not only to show that fact, but it also shows the difference in the kinds of education that we have. That is, when I was a fourth or fifth grader, and most of you, I would think, they told us the things they wanted us to know. Nowadays, they tell us the things that they want us to know, but they also want us to say what we think about them, to give our own thoughts. So I think this is what a result of that. These are things supposedly written by fifth graders to say something about Abraham Lincoln, what they'd learned. Abraham Lincoln lived in a log cabin. When he had to go to the bathroom, he had to go outside. Even in the winter, he was very sad. Abraham Lincoln didn't have television to watch when he was a kid, so he had to read books. It wasn't much fun being a kid in those days. Abraham Lincoln read his books and did his homework by the light of the fireplace. This is because he was too poor to pay the electric bill, and they turned off his That's a wonderful urban perspective on Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln was the best president we ever had. He was poor but honest. If he hadn't been so honest, he probably would have been rich. Just a couple more of these. Abraham Lincoln was called Honest Abe because he was an honest president. They shot him. And this last one. Abraham Lincoln was the first Republican president, but he was a good president in spite of this. Well, your theme is great presidents, great ideas. I think there are probably a lot of ways that we could fit Lincoln into that. But I think it's important to keep perspective on Lincoln, to realize that he was not a national hero when he was president by any means. He was a very controversial figure. He was elected as a dark horse in the minority party, which was very fortunate for him, and also very fortunate, the majority party fractionated and split their votes three ways, And so the minority party got elected. So Abraham Lincoln, not very well known nationally, became president. And most people, even the people in his own party, the leaders of his own party especially, were very nervous about having this inexperienced prairie politician who is known for his jokes and his good humor and his stump speeches, was going to be president. And it was the greatest crisis. It was mounting to be the greatest crisis in the national history. So people were very uneasy about Lincoln as president from the beginning. As many of you know, if you've read Doris Kearns Goodman's wonderful book about the Lincoln's cabinet, Team of Rivals, Lincoln had the audacity to take all the people who were ahead of him in the presidential race, in the Republican Party, who lost out to him, and put them in his cabinet. That in itself could be counted as a great idea, I think. And I think if you read Doris Kearns Goodman's book, you'll see that it was maybe a great idea only if you could make it work, if you could keep it from turning into chaos, which he managed to do. Well, the leading candidate was, as most of you know, I'm sure, William H. Seward, who had been longtime senator from New York. He'd been governor of the state. He was a very prominent politician, had been nationally known and recognized for years, was one of the great leaders, probably the most distinguished leader of the Republican Party, but he lost out in the nominating competition to Lincoln. Lincoln offered him the top spot in his cabinet. He thought about refusing, but he finally accepted mainly on the idea that he would probably be something like the prime minister. But Lincoln didn't know anything about running a country. He didn't know anything about national government. He didn't have any connections in foreign countries, as Seward did, and so forth. So he agreed to be Secretary of State on the idea that he would really be calling the shots. Here's something that I ran across that helps make this point in terms of what we're interested in today. Seward is writing about the early days of the Lincoln administration, which are filled with trouble, as you know, when Lincoln sat down as president at his desk on the first day, March the 5th, 1861, they handed him the Fort Sumter problem. And it got worse from there, as you know. At any rate, Seward is writing to Charles Francis Adams, who was named minister to another guy who thought he probably should have been president, minister to Great Britain. And here's the way he describes Lincoln on the basis of his first month or so. No system, no relative ideas, no conception of his situation, much absorption in the details of his office, but little application to great ideas. It's probably a little bit unfair to say that at the moment Seward's great idea, which he was pushing, was to declare war on Spain and France, and that would bring the Confederacy back in on the Union side to fight this foreign war. Not according to Lincoln, a very good idea. But I thought I would give as an example of what I consider a great idea of Lincoln's, and then say a few things about some of the ideas that he had and employed as a writer, which I talk about in my book. He came to the idea that it's important not to demonize your opponents. And he went to great lengths to adhere to this. Now, this isn't true of the early Lincoln. If you're interested in the early Lincoln, the Lincoln of New Salem, that wonderful guy who is reading books and educating himself and supporting himself, making his way in the world, that's a great part of his story. But when he became a politician, he became a very partisan politician, and the only thing, they didn't really have any great issues to argue about, so they fought each other. And, of course, this makes for all kinds of inelegant discourse. And Lincoln was, he rose in that situation. So he was as inelegant in his discourse as anybody. And he and his friends indulged in dirty tricks, race baiting. At one point in the notorious campaign of 1840, when they were trying to elect William Henry Harrison, on sheer hoopla, you know, the log cabin and cider campaign, one of Lincoln's friends came to him and said, "Lincoln, we're the Whigs. We're supposed to be the respectable party. And here we're doing all these crazy things that really don't have anything to do with politics. That's what the Democrats do. What are we doing these things?" And Lincoln, he says that, "No, we must fight the devil with fire. And so anything that is fair in love and politics." This was the kind of hack politician that he was in the 1830s and 40s. But nonetheless, there was a glimmer of the statesmanship that would come along later. For example, in his temperance speech of 1842, he talked about the temperance speech. He was asked to speak by the Washingtonians, who were a self-help group of drunkards, reformed drunkards, kind of like the AA today. And he said the old reformers took the position that habitual drunkards were utterly incorrigible and therefore must be turned adrift and damned without remedy. And this is an approach that he consciously rejects. He says, "There is something so repugnant to humanity, so uncharitable, so cold-blooded and feelingless that it never did nor never can enlist the enthusiasm of a popular cause." And I think he's telling us a lot about himself in that. You can't get anywhere this way. You can't make a political cause out of this. This is too uncharitable. This is too negative, we would say. And then what happens to Lincoln, of course, is that he becomes a statesman. He gets tired of politics. He goes to Congress. He doesn't have a very good time. He attacks the Mexican War, which his constituency is crazy about. And he comes home, and he's kind of disillusioned with politics, and he goes back to the practice of law, and he practiced harder than he ever had before. And he says he was losing interest in politics until 1854. And what happens in 1854 is things that are very hard to convey now, but everybody got all upset. The whole country got all shaken up by the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act and the repeal Missouri Compromise. Lincoln spent a long time researching in the state library a speech that he wanted to make about this. And he wasn't really running for office, he just wanted to make this statement. And when he got up and gave this great speech, he discovered that he had a tremendous response. People from the whole political spectrum. I mean, he'd been used to talking only to Whigs. And so that whenever he would inveigh against Stephen A. Douglas, they'd all hooray and so forth. But he was talking about something really important, the extension of slavery into the territories. And he discovered that this was, he could get, his way of looking at it could get a response. And this is when Lincoln becomes a statesman. And the principles are right there in the Peoria speech. He says, unlike the abolitionists who were like the old Lincoln, who were damning the slaveholders into eternity. These people are simply beyond help. He says, he takes the opposite tack. He says, "I have no prejudice against the Southern people. They are just what we would be in their situation. If slavery did not now exist amongst them, they would not introduce it. If it did now exist amongst us, we should not instantly give it up. I surely will not blame them for not knowing for not doing what I should not know how myself to do. If all earthly power were given me, I should not know what to do as to the existing institution." So this is a kind of golden rule that he installs. He gets the idea that our opponents are pretty much like we are, and if we were in their shoes, we'd be pretty much like them. Now this lays the groundwork for his behavior as president, where he refused to demonize the South. He didn't like to talk about traitors and treason, although he occasionally did in certain cases. He made a point. The Democrats immediately were the opponents of the war because it was a Republican war, and they said it was a sectional war. So he appointed Democratic governors, or Democratic generals and Democratic judges. This was terribly unpopular in his own party. And Lincoln had as much trouble with his own party, as I'm sure many of you know, as he did with the Democrats. He was an embattled president. And this is one of the reasons he insisted on appointing Democratic generals and Democratic governors, jobs that those good Republicans thought they deserved. The classic case, and there are several books lately that talk up this example, none better, I think, than William Lee Miller's book on called Lincoln's Virtues, is the case of Edwin Stanton. Stanton was a Democrat, a very strong Democrat, a very highly respected lawyer, and he said terrible things about Lincoln when he was the candidate for president. And after Lincoln was elected, he was fierce in his criticism of Lincoln. He said terrible things. In addition to which, Stanton had been part of a legal team that Lincoln had been asked to join in 1855. And when Lincoln, they were trying this case in Cincinnati, it was a big patent case. When Lincoln arrived as the Illinois representative, it was an Illinois company, Stanton and his friend simply froze Lincoln out of the team. So he had to kind of sit there and watch while the rest of the Eastern lawyers pled the case. So Lincoln had every reason to find somebody else besides Stanton. But there's this, as Bill Miller says, this golden thread of magnanimity that runs through Lincoln's presidency. And part of it is he needed a really strong, honest, tough Secretary of War. And he couldn't think of anybody better than Edwin Stanton, and he appointed him. Now, that's an idea that worked. It could have gone bad, I grant you. But it seems to me that all of Lincoln's ideas are of this sort. They come out of the situation, and he conceives, he's always thinking ahead, and he conceives of solutions. I want to just give you two examples of what I think are could be called great ideas that relate to his writing, which is what my book is about. Lincoln is a great American writer. My own interest in him is based on the fact that I taught American literature. I used to teach him every year in the survey, the famous pieces, and I admired him very much. But I wasn't so much engaged with him as a historical figure in the political process. But that changed a few years ago. My partner and I had started something that we call the Lincoln Studies Center, and we were doing editorial works for Lincoln, Lincoln Sources. And the Library of Congress approached us and said, we would like to have you do some animated, annotated transcriptions for the website. We're going to put up images of all Lincoln's papers on the web, and we would like to have transcriptions of the most important documents. So we agreed to do that, and we spent about 3 years in the process. And I became fascinated with the fact that the Library of Congress Lincoln papers, almost all the material in Lincoln's own hand, are what I would call composition drafts. They aren't, the letters aren't the letters that he sent out to the generals. They're his drafts of those letters. And so I got fascinated with these because they begin to show that Lincoln is a deliberate craftsman. He cares about nuance. He cares about gradations of meaning. He cares about whether we put it negatively or positively and so forth. So that's where my interest started in Lincoln. And then I discovered a lot of interesting things about Lincoln as a writer in the presidency. And so these two examples will be based on those. Early on, I found a description by his son, Robert Todd Lincoln. I didn't know it at the time, but this is a very incisive description of Lincoln as a writer. The elements that he talks about in here are crucial. Here's what he said. He was asked many years later, after his father's assassination, to describe his father as a writer. He was a very deliberate writer, anything but rapid. I cannot remember any peculiarity about his posture. He wrote sitting at a table, and as I remember, in an ordinary posture. As to dictation, I never saw him dictate to anyone, and it certainly was not his practice to do so. He seemed to think nothing of the labor of writing. I think that's a key. All of us hate writing. Lincoln is one of these rare people who didn't mind sitting down and spending hours and hours laboriously writing. He was accustomed to make scraps of notes and memoranda, another key aspect of his work. In writing a careful letter, he first wrote it himself, then corrected it, and then rewrote the corrected version himself. Now, these ideas that I'm talking about come out of Seward described in Lincoln's absorption in the nitty-gritty details of his office. The first great idea, it seems to me, came, or at least that I want to talk about. I don't want to say this is the first great idea he had. First one I want to talk about is the public letter. Everybody knows a little bit about the public letters. You know a few quotations. Most people know something about the famous letter to Horace Greeley. And that's where it all begins. Lincoln was, and his administration was in the doldrums in 1862. And he really wanted to do something that would start to affect public opinion. All through the 50s, he talks about the importance of public opinion. He's trying to create a new party. And he keeps telling his party members, public opinion is everything. If we can change public opinion just a little bit, then we can change government by that much. He's very much concerned that you can't really do anything against public opinion. And this is what's wrong with the abolitionist approach. So try to get some, try to shape public opinion if you can. So Lincoln, administration is in the doldrums. The military situation is terrible in summer of 1862. He gets this idea that this is the time to proclaim emancipation as a military measure. And he tells his cabinet, this is what I want to do. And they say, well, okay, if you want to do it, but it's going to be unpopular. It's going to cost us the next election. But you sure shouldn't do it until we have a victory because we're just getting beat all over the place. So while he's waiting for a victory to come along, which doesn't come along until September, it's August, and he sits somebody down and reads them something he's written. This is also another thing that he always does. He always wants to hear it. He's orally engaged in the language. He sits him down to read, and so they're pondering, how would I get this before the public? And they open the newspaper, and lo and behold, Horace Greeley, this ill-tempered editor who's supposed to be a supporter of Lincoln but who is always criticizing, has a long, rambling editorial against Lincoln, scolding him. And so Lincoln writes a little introduction paragraph, and he publishes this little piece that he'd already written ahead of time. And you all know how it goes. It's the one that goes, I would save the Union. My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union. It's not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. If I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could free it by freeing some and leaving others, I would also do that. This last part is exactly what he's going to do. He's going to proclaim emancipation, but only in the parts of the country that are in rebellion. So this won't free any states, any slaves in loyal states. So he's immediately he's ridiculed in the newspapers. This is unprecedented. Presidents don't do this. Emerson says in his diary, responding to letters to editors just cheapens yourself. It's another evidence that Lincoln doesn't know what he's doing. He's the wrong guy for the job. But this letter is written in this kind of crisp, lean prose that you can almost repeat it after you've read it the first time. And, of course, it's a presidential letter. It's on the front pages of the newspapers. Everybody reads it and argues about it. And finally, when you shake it all out, it has a good effect. He gets into trouble over the curtailment of civil liberties, a subject that's still a good deal written and discussed, because he did suspend habeas corpus a number of times and places, and they did arrest newspaper editors. They detained people without trial and so forth for military purposes. And when they arrested a former congressman, Clement Vlandingham, for making a political speech, the country really got very upset, and there were meetings held everywhere. And Lincoln replied in a letter in June of 63 to a petition that was sent to him from a bunch of Democrats in Albany, New York. But, and it was a very successful letter. He did manage to explain how he was using his war powers, and he calmed people down, and he inspired confidence. Somebody called on him a few months later and said, "Boy, I really like that letter that you wrote to the Albany petitioners." And he said, "You know how I wrote that letter?" He's sitting at his desk. He says, "When it came time to write that letter, I had it all right here." He pulled up in his drawer. And he says, I had it in scraps and memoranda that I had written. And whenever I would think of a defense that I could make of my policies, I would write it down and put it in this drawer. And when the petition came from Albany, I opened the drawer and I had what I needed. Well, he'd been doing this for a long time. There's a famous story about how he wrote the House Divided speech. Herndon, his law partner, says that he kept writing down little things on scraps of paper and sticking them in his hat. And then when it came to time to write the letter, he dumped his hat out on the table, and then he went through all those little scraps and memoranda, and he numbered them. And then he arranged them in numerical order, and then he wrote out his speech. So this is, and we have lots of testimony from his secretaries and people close to him about his, this is his way of composition. But the important thing to notice is that he wrote the Greeley letter before Greeley wrote him. He had the material for the Corning letter, the Albany letter. He was just waiting for the right occasion. And here, a convention of Democrats, this is the perfect target, that he can use all of his Andrew Jackson examples, because Andrew Jackson suspended habeas corpus and did all kinds of arbitrary things. Well, he wrote other letters, but the next major letter that he wrote was the letter when he wanted to. He had two big problems. Even though they were winning in the summer of 63, Gettysburg and Vicksburg, he had two problems. One is the draft, which was terribly unpopular. The other was that people were still unhappy about using black troops. This was not popular in the Army, and it was not popular in the Northern public. And so he decided to write a... We have a draft that he made, manuscript draft, where he's talking about both of these things. But what he decides to do is to drop the draft and to just write a letter defending black troops. And he waits until he gets invited to come out to Springfield, his hometown, and address a mass meeting that they're arranging. They're trying to get all the people who support the war, Democrats and Republicans and others, to come together, and they'll get the president to come out and give a speech. And so he says, "Well, I'll come out if I can. If I can't, I'll write a letter." So a few days later, people said, "Well, are you going to go?" He says, "No, I'm not going to go, but I'm going to send a letter, and it'll be a good letter." He knew that because he'd already written it. This is the letter that ends with this marvelous appeal to the nobility of the efforts of the black troops. He says, "When peace comes, it will then have been proved that among free men there can be no successful appeal from the ballot to the bullet, and that they who take such an appeal are sure to lose their case and pay the cost. And then there will be some black men who can remember that with silent tongue and clenched teeth and steady eye and well-poised bayonet, they have helped mankind on to this great consummation. While I fear there will be some white ones unable to forget that with malignant heart and deceitful speech, they strove to hinder it." This letter, published in September of of 63 had tremendous effect. And it turned around a lot of people who were very dubious about him. Somehow, especially his radical critics, all of whom wanted stronger action of this sort. If you look in Lincoln's papers, the mail that he gets on this is terrific. You can see that it was very successful. I'll just give you one more example, the Hodges letter. And he's there trying to make the point that the president just doesn't impose his will on the country. So here's his famous early part of the Hodges letter. I'm naturally anti-slavery. If slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong. I cannot remember when I did not so think and feel. And yet, I never understood that the presidency conferred upon me an unrestricted right to act officially upon this judgment and feeling. It was in the oath I took that I would, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. I could not take the office without taking the oath. These letters cumulatively had a great effect, and Lincoln they stopped saying, you know, this is unprecedented, this is undignified, he shouldn't do it. And the best they could do is say, well, this man has no writing ability. This is silly. After the Hodges letter, Greeley, who was trying to promote dumping Lincoln from the Republican ticket and no friend of him, said to his fellow anti-Lincolnians, I think it's time that we just stop saying that Lincoln doesn't know how to write and making fun of him. Now, I'm running out of time, but I'd like to just quickly say something about another thing that I think. I think it was a great idea to try to influence the public through public letters. But, of course, you had to have the ability to write, and you had to have the tough enough skin to take the heat that you would get initially. But Lincoln was that kind of man. A second great idea is reintroducing the Declaration. In the 50s, the Declaration started to be attacked. Glittering generalities, they said, self-evident lies. This really offended Lincoln. He grew up during the years when the Declaration was being canonized, and he really believed in the Declaration and especially the great principles in the prologue. And his experience had shown him that the thing that most resonates, he talks about this in his speeches, even with new immigrants who hadn't been there in the Revolutionary, who couldn't connect themselves to the people who drew the Declaration, the phrase, all men are created equal, had this kind of resonance. It sort of vibrated. And so he tried to play on that in the 50s. He made it an issue with Douglas. By the time of the secession, they had to stop talking about equality because it had become a fighting word. And so Lincoln, if you remember, on his way to the presidency, he gives speeches where he keeps talking about the revolutionary cause. When he goes to Philadelphia, he talks about the Declaration, but he doesn't quote the line, all men are created equal. Playing into his hands, the vice president of the Confederacy, Alexander Stevens, declares in what's called the Cornerstone speech that the cornerstone, now that they've got their own country, the Confederacy, the cornerstone is going to be the inequality of people. That's the great truth that they're building the Confederacy on. So Lincoln, when he sees the Battle of Gettysburg, he decides it's time to reintroduce the Declaration, and it's what he thinks of its greatest line. And he does. When they come to serenade him after the victories at Vicksburg and Gettysburg, which came almost on the same day, he says, he usually just says, I'm not going to make a speech. I don't want to say anything foolish. Please go ahead and play the music. But this time he had something he wanted to say. He says, I see in a succession of battles in Pennsylvania, which continued 3 days, so rapidly one following the other as to be justly called a great battle, and brought forth on the 1st and 2nd and 3rd of July, and on the 4th, the enemies of the Declaration that all men are created equal had to turn tail and run. Gentlemen, this is a glorious theme and a glorious occasion for a speech. but I'm not prepared to make one worthy of the theme and worthy of the occasion. But that shows you that he was thinking of a speech that would be worthy of the theme. And that speech, of course, was the Gettysburg Address, where he gets the whole argument into the first sentence, so that if you agree with the first sentence, you're lost if you take a different position. And I could say more about that, but I've got to leave time for at least a few questions, so I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
I think I'm speaking for all of us. You're not running out of time, and you can spend it as long as you want.
Hi, I do have a question. I think this idea of presidents and candidates finding the right medium of expression for the time so they can speak directly to the people is a terrific idea. Public letters, fireside chats, press conferences, televised debates. If you were asked today by the candidates what would be the best medium to speak directly, blogging, Facebook page, going on Jon Stewart, what would be your advice?
Well, that requires you to be familiar and expert in the current media, which I'm not. And I think it's like everything else in history. We keep getting surprised. The people who thought they knew how to finance campaigns got surprised. And so the people who gave that advice didn't give good advice because they couldn't anticipate. So I'm not going to get involved in that, but I want to agree with you that FDR's fireside chats, if you listen to some of the good ones, are just terrific. And he really does make contact. You can just feel it. Some press conferences, of course, have the opposite effect if you stumble and misspeak and so forth. So finding the right medium is the trick. I'm not sure exactly what it would be today. Yes?
I love the book, Lincoln's Sword, so thank you for that, and thank you for
your
remarks this morning. It was just a wonderful, wonderful book. I closed it still wondering, where did all this come from? Where did this writing ability come from? And I know it's mysterious, ultimately, but try the best you can.
Ultimately, it's mysterious, but what people didn't understand was that Lincoln is a lifelong writer. You can tell by the descriptions that we have that when he first learned to write as a boy of 6, he learned to write in Kentucky. He left Kentucky when he was 7. He learned to write very early. Neither one of his parents could write. He talks about liking to make the shapes of the letters when he was learning his letters. When he got to Indiana, he was a neighborhood secretary. He was one of the few people in his neighborhood who could write. And he wrote letters for people to send back to Kentucky. He was an aspiring poet. We have just some few fragments of things. He wrote essays. He wrote essays on causes like cruelty to animals, the temperance, the big social issue. And he continued to write for the newspapers when he got to Illinois, except that he wrote in a medium where the articles were always either anonymous or pseudonymous. You didn't sign your own name. So it's very hard to find which put a name to those. So, but the ones that we can identify are not very edifying. It's this raw-boned political style. But he was writing all of his life. And, of course, he had a gift for words. He was a concern for meaning, too. His stepmother talks about how if he ever heard a word he didn't understand, he was unhappy. And he would write it down. He would write sentences, that kind of thing. So he had a lot of experience as a writer that people didn't realize.
If you could describe your feeling about the first passage in the Gettysburg Address and how it succeeds in bringing about the rest of the argument.
I think he framed it 67 years ago. Our fathers brought forth upon this continent. Now, this is a stately rhythm, and our fathers and the continent and all of this is helping to create a mood. A government so conceived and so dedicated. Well, what he gets down to is the whole country, the whole is dedicated to one proposition. The proposition that all men are created equal. Now that doesn't sound like anything that anybody would want to doubt. But the next sentence, Now we are engaged in a great civil war to see whether a nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. At that point, many Americans would say, wait a minute, we are not fighting for equality. That is not what we're fighting for. We are fighting for union, and we're trying to put down a rebellion and preserve the union. And, of course, this is exactly what the Democratic papers say. There are people who noticed it right away, percepted and said, this is something unusual, this is really good. But most people, it passed them by, and it didn't become important till later. And the more people, because it's so beautifully framed, so well written, and has so much packed into this little package, it's irresistible, and people keep reciting it and saying it. And eventually it becomes part of what we believe or part of what people think is. But the idea that the country was conceived and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal, that's Lincoln's idea. That isn't an idea that he got from somewhere else. It's gradually become more and more the country's idea. Yes.
Stefan Edlis here. For a number of years now, I've been concerned about Lincoln's success in keeping the Union together because an incredibly high price was paid. But in the past 100 years, we're still not the Union that he envisioned. Was he really right? Was he that great? Was that a great idea to keep the Union together?
Well, a lot of people, especially in the 20th century, would say no, that somehow it was a mistake. They would have been better to settle with the Confederacy. But I think that's a minority opinion. And I think most people think that there had to be some kind of crunch. There had to be a showdown. And that Lincoln's successor was as against secession as he was, James Buchanan. Seward, who was a wit, characterized Buchanan's policy as no state has a right to secede from the Union unless they want to. Lincoln's idea was no state has the right to secede. And if I'm going to preserve the Union, I'm going to do whatever I have to do. So I think over time, in balance, you can make an argument that they might have avoided the terrible, terrible cost. Nobody felt worse about the cost than Lincoln. But I think the balance of judgment is that he made the right decision. He did the right thing.
I think we have time for one more.
This might not be the right last question. It's a random thought following up on the last question. If they had let the South secede, how long do you think slavery would have lasted? Or would it?
I have no idea. I have fears that it would have gone on and on and on.
Thank you all very much for being here. Let's give Professor Wilson a round of applause.